Welcome to a new exciting share on iLED.com. This year is entitled Honorable Mention. It'll be a long series, God willing, where we're going to explore the elements of being a more menschlich person, more a respectful person, try and improve our moral sensitivity, our perfection of our ethical attributes. Most importantly, it's a boot camp, it's a workshop for being a more kinder individual to other people, more focused on others. Far be it for me to be one entitled to give this share, but I also want to learn from this, so we've gone into the sources, and we'll try and make this a forum. As we've discovered the leadership of Na'aleh, and before we go any further, let's mention that today's year is Lili Nishmas Rachaleh Bas Rechaim Tzvi, Lashon. I'd also like to thank Mrs. Tzipi Klaver, who is the brilliant brain behind all these great ideas, and also, thank also today in the studio, we have Mrs. Libby Bonzer, Yael is here today, JJ is here today, so we have an exciting studio for this kickoff of the new shir of being honorable mention. Okay, so basically one has to come to the conclusion, if you are not a better person, if you are not a more compassionate and empathetic individual at the age of 60 than you were at the age of 25, then there's something fundamentally wrong with your life. So why wait till we get to this later age? Let's think about now already how we can improve and enhance our life, being more honorable people. But we become good people by doing actions, not thinking about them. It's not enough just to think I want to do something good, and even say I want to do something good, and make a resolution. We have to actually do it. We have to compel ourselves to fulfill that which we say we're going to do. It has to become part of our nature. Rabbi Joseph Telushkin wrote a masterwork called "To Be You Shall Be Holy." You Shall Be Holy, which I'll be referring to a lot in the course of this course. And he quotes an interesting anecdote from his friend, Dr. Ike Hirschkopf, a psychiatrist. He had a patient who had a tremendous phobia of dogs. And the woman just was unable to be in the presence of a dog. She'd run for her life. And then she stopped seeing this doctor. And then she had a baby boy. And she'd take the baby on strolls. And she called up the doctor and said, "Doctor, what shall I do? I don't want my baby to inherit my fear of dogs." And the doctor said to her, "It's not something that you can inherit, but rather it's something which you can condition." So what this woman would do is, she'd be walking in the park, a dog would approach, she would clench her eyes, hold her breath, but she wouldn't flee for her baby's sake. She didn't want her baby to have the fear that she had. She did this time after time, and not only did her baby not have a phobia, she cured her own problem. In other words, it's not enough to talk about something, you have to do something. And then, there will be results. There's a rabbinic passage, this is in the Tanhuma of Vayakil, that there are three names that a person is given. One name given by father and mother, one name given by your peers, your folk, your contemporaries, and one name which is the one that lasts with you. One name which is a name that you acquire. And says the Medrash that of all the names, the one your parents give you, one that your peers give you, and the one that you acquire, the most important one, is the one that you acquire. And again, here I give credit to Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, who had a fabulous example. The best example is, again, the name that you're given is your name. Susie, Barbara, Chaim, Maishi, that's the name that your parents gave you. The one your peers give you is one who is, let's say, one who is a prompt individual, one who is a moody individual. And then there's a reputation, which is far more than that. And his example was Oscar Schindler. Oscar Schindler was a flawed individual. He's a man with a checkered past. He was a womanizer. He was a dishonest businessman. But what we also know, and this is exactly what we remember, is that he saved 1,100 Jews, putting himself in peril many, many times in the course of the Holocaust. He put his life at risk and used tremendous ingenuity to save these Jews' lives. And forever after, he'll always be associated with this, of being a great person, a paragon of mankind. The name which he acquired is the greatest of all. And that's what we want to do. Being a menschlicher person means making sure that your reputation, and for this requires a little ingenuity to think towards the future. And I don't want to be gruesome, but picture a shul in the future. Your shul. And there is your levaya, there's your funeral. What are they saying about you? That you're a kindly individual, one who cared for your parents, one who cared for their children, one who spent time on those that were near to them, or one who was only concerned about his own egocentric concerns, one who was only concerned about his own satisfaction. And if you think about this, it gives a person perspective, it gives one pause, and that can motivate and catalyze action. A For this reason, because we want to be people that are better individuals, we have to make it our business to seek out a neighborhood where people have good character. Even if it means paying a higher rent to live in a building where there are people of better moral persuasion. And as a friend of mine pointed out, it's not just people to live in a good neighborhood, but also people often look for a school when they have a little child, and they look at the preschool, the kindergarten, the nursery, pre-1A, as they call it in New York. But my friend pointed out, it'd be far better, this is Daniel Taub, who said, they should look at the 6th grade, the 8th grade, 12th grade. What are the people who graduate the school? What kind of people are they? If you're really concerned about a person's character, it's not just how they treat a little child, but what kind of character will develop in the child when they'll emerge from the school. That would be a very important criterion. And as we know what an influence can do, we often hear, we know that it's much more common for a child to go onto drugs because of that influence, and far less common that someone go off of drugs because there's been a good influence. So the impact of an environment, a sviva, is so critically important in how we develop our character. Excuse me. There is a phenomenon which has become very well known lately in criminology. Malcolm Gladwell brings this point in Tipping Point, called the broken window theory. He didn't make up this concept. I forget the name of the man who developed it. It goes like this. If you see a building with a broken window and it's not repaired, and days lapse and it's still not repaired, before you know it, there'll be two broken windows and yet another broken window. And then it'll become a crack house and it'll reek of urine. And because things which are not in good shape just create an environment which is conducive for creating more things that are not in good shape. And this theory of broken window was actually put into practice in the 1980s in New York City. At that time, it was at the very nadir of the transit authority, and those who rode the subways were only the denizens of the night. Those had no other recourse, but it was at the lowest ever subway ridership. And the New York City Police Department and the transit authority were betwixt themselves. What could they do to try and increase ridership on the subways? And they hired a person, again, I forget this gentleman's name, and he decided he's going to work with the broken window theory, which meant he's going to make sure there's no problems at all with the subway. And the first thing he wished to eliminate was the graffiti. He said, graffiti? That's what you're worried about? There are so many problems. There's muggings. There's knifings. There's horrible crimes. No, it's a broken window. We have to make sure there's not an environment which invites more crime. So what happened is they would park the trains uptown Manhattan. Kids would come at night. They would paint over the sides of the subway cars. It was a three-day process. Paint the cars, that was one day. Second day, they would draw outlines of what they wanted to graffiti. And third day, they fill it in. And they saw to it that a train would not go back on the track till all the graffiti was taken off. They paint right over it. And after days, the kids would start crying. They worked so hard, and all the work was demolished. But getting rid of this graffiti was a message. We're not going to we're not going to tolerate any infraction on the subway. Then what happened is they decided they're going to go down, bear down on the fare breakers. People who would not pay for the subway fare. Now, at the time, it cost $1.25 for a token to get onto the subway. I said, Mr. Meshuga, how in the world are you going to stop fare breakers? Now, I once actually took a train, and I got off in Harlem, and I saw a whole bunch of people jumping over the turnstile, going underneath it, going through the door, and all this was illegal. And I'm convinced that many, many people that would have been happy to pay their fare, they felt like suckers. They're going to pay when someone else isn't. It just bred other people to break the fare. So what this fellow decided was he's going to do is he's going to arrest everyone. He said, you can't arrest, because if you arrest a kid for jumping the turnstile, you're going to take a cop out of commission for one full day. Not only that, you take a cop out of commission for $1.25, and not only that, but then he's going to have to appear in court weeks later for the trial. So you take a cop out of service for 2 days for $1.25. It doesn't make sense. There's not enough policemen as it is. So he said, no, you have to stop everything. So he had 10 plainclothes policemen in the subway stations. A person jumped the fare. They arrested him, put him in cufflinks. Handcuffs. Then the next one they arrested, and they tied him to the next one. People walked in the subway, so a whole row of people handcuffed. Then they reconfitted a bus. They took all these people who had broken the fare out to the bus, and they busted them, they booked them, and they were back inside arresting more people half an hour later. And what happened was, by doing this, and they also had a bonanza, they found one out of four people, which they arrested, had a, for breaking the fare, had a concealed weapon on them, an illegal weapon, and they found one out of seven had a criminal past. They'd already been arrested once before, and they were just cleaning the streets. And after a while, people learned very carefully that they don't go to the subway with a weapon on their body. And they certainly stopped breaking the fare. And in the blink of an eye, subway ridership went up, and then Mayor Giuliani, when he was elected, hired this person to be the head of not transit authority, but the police commission. He became commissioner, and on the day that Giuliani became the mayor of New York, when he was sworn in, he said, "We're going after the squeegee boys." What? Today? The day you're elected, you're being sworn in? Yes, the squeegee boys. These are the kids that stand at the traffic lights and your car is stopped. They wipe your window, as it were, and then expect a tip, and it's panhandling. And it's annoying. And he said, "We're going after them. We want to clean up the city. We have to start somewhere." And sure enough, in the blink of an eye, New York City became, from the worst, the safest major city in the United States. That's the idea of the broken window. Likewise with character. With character, it means we have to start somewhere. And you have to go one piece by piece and realize, and you have to tip the scale. Because if we do more and more things, we won't make an environment which is conducive to having a faulty character. And altogether, we want to do some spot cleaning and rectify the situation. Okay, another thing of not being selfish is we have to pray for other people. And Chazal teach, it's much more efficacious and puissant to pray for the other person before you pray for yourself. I care about them. I'm concerned for them. They shouldn't have misfortune. They should be blessed with children. They should be blessed with getting married. They should have job security. I care about someone else. I'm going to pray on their behalf. Okay, now when you're confronted with a situation and you're not sure what should you do, the dilemma really is, and this is, again, Rabbi Tlushkin points out, you have to ask what is motivating you. Is it your Yetzer HaTov or is it your Yetzer HaRa? Are you being motivated by the good inclination or the bad inclination? And if you can make this analysis and you can diagnose, why am I doing this? It's because I'm going to try and satisfy my pleasures. That will be a beastly kind of concept, one of the evil inclination. Or is I'm doing because I really intend to do good? If you can make that analysis, you'll be able to tip virtually all of your acts. To me, this is reminiscent of the Panovich Rav. The great Rav of Panovich had a dilemma. He was in his young 20s, he was learning with great diligence, and he was offered to deliver a shiur. His dilemma, he was impaled in the horns of the following dilemma. If he were to deliver a shiur, that would mean that he'd have to leave full-time learning. Now, delivering a shiur is a wonderful thing, but it means time, a lot of time being preparing the shiur and delivering the shiur and fielding questions. And it's not actual time that we spend netto, exactly, precisely, exclusively learning. On the other hand, perhaps, if he were to wait and not deliver shiur now and start delivering shiur when he's 50 years old, there'd be so much more within him that he could give to others, and the shiur would be much more richer and have much more content. What should he do? And who can answer such a question? He went to his Rebbe, the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim said that he should do whatever will bring about more kvod shamayim. Whatever will bring about more honor for heaven, that should direct you. Said the Panovich Rav, the rest of my life, basically I never had a dilemma. I plugged in that formula. What will bring about more honor for heaven? And I was able to decide what to do. In those difficult days, and all the refugees in Lithuania prior to his fleeing with World War II, trying to set up the yeshiva environment and infrastructure in Israel during World War II, and then creating the Renaissance of Torah movement in Israel after that, he only had one question. What will bring about more kvod shamayim? And with that, he was able to decide most of his dilemmas. Now, if we can make commitments upon ourselves, now, really what happens is the reason that Yom Kippur is so effective to get a person to focus on doing tshuva, because we realize the stakes are for real. We realize that on Yom Kippur, that for 24 hours, we're supposed to lead an existence which is not so physical. We refrain from eating, from drinking, from all kinds of physical pleasures on Yom Kippur, and we spend the day in a kittel, dressed in white, and this confrontation is to make a certain sense of reality, to avoid all those deathbed regrets that people have at the very end of their lives, to make a resolution now, in Kippur time, that this coming year I'm really going to be a better person, a better individual. We make that commitment. And the guidelines are, we can summarize them in two mitzvot. One is to be a holy person. Kedoshim to be holy. And it's a very famous interpretation of the Ramban, Nachmanides. It means like this, that the Torah is speaking here is that it's a rule which will apply in every situation. The Torah never forbids eating, and yet we're forbidden to be a glutton. We're allowed to drink, but if you become a drunk, that's not a holy person. I'll give you one last example. We know that we're supposed to give 1/10 of our income to charity. So let's say you get your check from work, made out $10,000, and you decide you're doing something worthy and write out a check, $1,000, to give to Na'aled.com. A very worthwhile idea. So you write out the check, put in the envelope, and you're walking outside to put it in the mailbox, and just then you see a bum lying in the gutter, says, "I'm starving, please give me a drink, give me a dime." Says, "Sorry, sir, I fulfilled my mitzvah," and drop the envelope in the mailbox. That may be a mitzvah to do, but you're not a holy person. A holy person means I exceed, I sanctify that which is not, even that which I'm not obliged to do. Kadosh atzmacha b'mutalach, even those things which I'm not required to do, I'm going to elevate myself and be holier in that regard as well. That's one important thing. Then we have another mitzvah from the Torah, which is besisim hayosher v'hatov, which is you must do that which is good and right in the eyes of God. Even if there's not a specific command, to do things which are always right and good. For example, there is no obligation to give a waiter a tip when you go into the restaurant, but that would be good and right in the eyes of God. If someone needs help, to go out of your way, that's good and right in the eyes of God. You can't say you're compelled to do it, but that's doing right and good in the eyes of God. The Torah commands we have to walk after the ways of God. How can we walk after the ways of God? The best way to do this is to lead a life which is a blessing. And that brings people to think about God. Your actions are motivated by God. That is the beginnings. This is the fulcrum of becoming a person who is a mensch. And we conclude that the Gemara says in Chulin Daf Zayin on the base that righteous people are greater, even greater after their death. Gadol mis tzaddikim b'misasam yosim b'chayehim. Greater is a tzaddik, a righteous, pious, saintly individual in their death than their lifetime. This is counterintuitive. You would think that a person in their lifetime, when they're alive and they have influence and power, they'd be far more puissant and efficacious and have greater influence than they would after their death posthumously. So, again, I give credit to Joseph Tolushkin. He gave a good example of Rabbi Aryeh Levin. Rabbi Aryeh Levin was a very righteous, pious person, and after he passed away, a fellow named Simcha Raz wrote a biography called Ish Tzadik Haya, translated in English as A Tzadik in Our Time. And from ever after, that book became so popular, and the anecdotes so moving and poignant, that from ever after, people associate Tzadik Rabbi Aryeh Levin, the Tzadik of Jerusalem. And there are many stories about him that everyone seems to know. He once went with his wife to the doctor, and the doctor said, "What's the problem?" And Rabbi Levin said, "My wife's foot hurts us." He felt her pain like his pain. And that, even after he's dead, people are still reading the book, being influenced by it. Gadol misasam. We were privileged to write the biography of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. In his lifetime, he was recognized as among the greatest poskim in our generation, and a man of tremendous character. And yet, after he passed away, when the stories emerged, it changed people's lives. I'll give two examples. One is, there was a couple in Jerusalem that had a profoundly retarded son whom they could not keep at home, and they were now impaled in the horns of dilemma. What to do with this child? There were but two institutions where to send him. One was religiously superior to the other. One was medically inferior. We'll call them A and B. A was religiously superior to B, but medically inferior. B was medically superior, but religiously inferior. I just confused. I did not intend to. One more time. One was medically better. One was religiously better. What should they do? This is a good question for a great rabbi. They went to Shlomo Zalman. What shall we do? Shlomo Zalman says, "Well, what does your son say?" And began to fidget. It wasn't exactly someone they consulted. Certainly not by a matter like this. He said to them, "Chotim b'nefesh hayelad, you're sitting on the child's account. You wish to send him to a prison like Ambiance, to an institution, feel penned in. If you don't get his consent, he'll always resent and hold this against you. Where is this boy?" "Why, he's outside in a taxi. I'd like you to bring him up." So he brought up to the boy, to the man who despised honor, who was allergic to titles, couldn't tolerate any covet whatsoever. He said to Shlomo Zalman, "My son, what's your name?" "My name is Akiva." Said Rabbi Auerbach, "My name is Shlomo Zalman, and I'm the Gadol Hador. I'm the most prominent rabbi of this generation, and you're now going to go to school, which requires a lot of help in religious matters. And I want you to be my rep, be my representative, and look after matters for me. Kashrut and Shabbat. And then make sure that you can help me. I'm going to bestow upon you smicha and give you rabbinic ordination." "What?" "Yes, I'm going to give you smicha." "You're going to give me smi? "Oh, yes. You're going to give me smi?" He started smiling up into the ears, into the stratosphere. "Really? Oh, yes. I'm also going to give you responsibility to be my rep." He said, "Can you help me out?" "Oh, Rabbi, I'll do it. And on more than one occasion, his parents wished him to come home for Shabbos. He said, how can I come home? The Galdor sent me here. I'm his representative. For so my mom could speak to everyone, most erudite, and the lowest, and everyone in between. And this story now has become such a popular story, how to relate to other people. One other story. We didn't know in his lifetime, but that story has had such an impact after he's passed away. Gadol tzadikim b'misasim, yosim b'chayehem. Just tell you one other story, which was, is that Shlomo Zalman had a famous relationship with his wife. He said to his wife of 2 or 3 minutes, I mean, how long could they have been married? He said this to her in the Cheder Yichud, let's make a deal. From now on, if we ever have an argument, you're right. And he abided by this arrangement. Indeed, his wife passed away. She became ill on a Thursday night. That Shabbos, she was gone. That Matzoi Shabbos, he went to the hospital, as it were, to bid farewell and sign documentation. There were people in the hospital who had no idea what he was doing there. One person, his wife had just given birth. He went to Shlomo Zalman, could you please give me a bracha? My wife just gave birth. And he put on that tremendous smile, which he always had. A smile that Hollywood could never mimic. It was just a portal to the soul. He wished him well, and that night was a funeral. Because of the sanctity of Jerusalem, we don't allow a corpse to lie overnight in Jerusalem, and that night was a funeral. As he stood at the fresh graveside of his wife, he proclaimed that as minhag Yisrael, it is the custom among the Jewish people, if chalila, a spouse has inflicted harm upon a spouse, you beg nechila and ask forgiveness, but I have nothing to ask forgiveness for never did I ever frustrate her, or did she ever irritate me. And thus testified the man of truth about a marriage which spanned over a yovel, over 50 years, 52 years. The man of truth said this, and that story has also become widespread. Everyone knows the story now, which he proclaimed. Even after he's living, his influence is impacting on others. May the will of God that all of us should improve our character and create for ourselves that kind of name which will change. Now, I just want to give one more word, which I sort of said in the beginning, is that this course, we're talking about important things, how to improve ourselves. They're going to be bite sizes. We'll never exceed 25 minutes, and we finish our first installment today.